This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. All episodes out now.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Science Weekly is supported by Rainforest Trust. In honor of this year's Earth Day, we're promoting Rainforest Trust's Brazilian Amazon Fund throughout April. Rainforest Trust is a 501c3 organization, which means that 100% of all money donated goes directly to conservation efforts. The fund has already helped protect more than 6.5 million acres of rainforest habitat, but Rainforest Trust still needs to protect a further 13 million acres to reach its goal. You can help. Donate online at rainforesttrust.org/earthday this April, and your generous gift will be quadruple matched for the Brazilian Amazon.
Today marks the 60th anniversary of a medical breakthrough, the discovery of Epstein-Barr virus. And though you might not know the name, the chances are it's living inside you.
So Epstein-Barr virus is a remarkable virus. It's the most common infection in humans of any virus. And when we get infected, it lives in our bodies silently for the rest of our lives.
It's spread through saliva, so a mother kissing her baby or a couple of friends sharing a drink. And it's thought that up to 96% of us have it. But its effects can vary depending, for example, on when you catch it.
Most people get infected as babies and as youngsters and have no ill effects whatsoever. They don't even know they're infected. For those individuals that get infected in early teenage life or early adulthood, around 50% of people will get a condition called glandular fever.
But here's what was really groundbreaking about its discovery.
For certain individuals, the virus can spark off cancer or indeed is associated with other chronic conditions like multiple sclerosis.
Epstein-Barr was the first virus to be identified as a cause of cancer in humans. Since then, other viruses like hepatitis C and HPV have also been linked to cancer. This has led to life-saving developments, like the HPV vaccine, which is now given to teenage girls to reduce their chances of getting cervical cancer. But it's not just cancer. As Lawrence mentioned, EBV is also implicated in multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases. So, 60 years on, how has this discovery shaped medicine? And how can it help us prevent and treat cancer and other illnesses? From The Guardian, I'm Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly. Lawrence Young, you're a virologist and professor of molecular oncology at the University of Warwick's Medical School, and you've studied the Epstein-Barr virus. So take us back 60 years. How did the discovery of this virus first come about?
So the discovery of Epstein-Barr virus took place in this lab in Middlesex Hospital. Actually, there were three people involved: Tony Epstein, Yvonne Barr, who was working as alongside as a scientist in growing cells in culture, and a guy called Bert Achong. The discovery of Epstein-Barr virus, I think like many breakthroughs in science, owes much to serendipity. It was during the 1950s that Tony Epstein had been working on a virus that we'd known for many years was associated with cancer in chickens. There was a lot of skepticism at the time as to whether viruses would be associated with human cancer. But Epstein was very convinced that this would be the case. And by sheer chance, he attended a lecture in March 1961 by Dennis Burkitt. And he was a surgeon who'd been working in Africa. And he discovered a tumour in the jaw of youngsters in Africa that seemed to be associated with climate. And this led Epstein to conclude that this might be an infectious agent. And then they worked together over a number of years, with Dennis Burkitt sending biopsies to Tony Epstein's lab. And after many, many years and many false starts, Tony Epstein was able to see some virus in a sample that was sent from Africa in late December 1963 and published the seminal paper then in 1964.
So this form of cancer, which is known as Burkitt lymphoma, is very rare, but it led to the discovery of the virus and eventually the association between other cancers and EBV. But when did we find out just how widespread EBV is?
Once you discover a virus, you can start to look at whether or not people have antibodies to a virus. And what was the big surprise was that a couple of years, 1966, a lab in Philadelphia run by a husband and wife team, Gertrude and Verna Henley, found that nearly everybody had antibodies to Epstein-Barr virus. And this was a big surprise because, of course, once you identified this virus associated with cancer, the idea was this would be specifically associated with infection in those individuals. But it turns out that 96% of the population are infected with EBV.
So there's something very strange going on here. I mean, EBV is found to be extraordinarily common, so common that it's actually stranger if you don't have it. But this Burkitt lymphoma was constrained to this particular region of Africa. How was that sort of mismatch resolved?
Well, I think it was resolved over a period of years once we also found that the virus is associated with other types of cancer. So the first thing was that there was a cancer that was discovered, and again, in the late 60s, of the nasal passages, the nasopharynx, that's quite common in Southeast Asia, completely different type of tumour from Burkitt lymphoma, that was also found to be associated with Epstein-Barr virus, and then a whole heap of other lymphomas. So those of us that have studied this tumour in Southeast Asia recognise that it's the complex interaction between the virus, the ethnicity of the individuals, and that again affects the way the body responds immunologically to infection, but also to diet. And salted fish in the Cantonese diet has been linked to nasopharyngeal carcinoma. So what you've got is multiple mutations with the virus contributing an essential key component on the pathway that leads to cancer, but not everybody's exposed to all the other factors in the same way. One thing's for sure that we do know is that the body's immune system is intimately associated with controlling this virus. It has to be controlled because it infects all of us. So how the body controls the infection is really important. And immunosuppression is a particular risk factor for developing certain EBV-associated tumours.
Okay, so it's this complex mix of factors, diet, genetics, lifestyle, and so on, which determine whether and what kind of cancer this virus might trigger inside us. And to be clear, EBV is only responsible for 1% of cancers. So although most of us have it, it won't lead to disease for the vast majority. And today, Lawrence, virologists and oncologists like yourself know far more about how viruses can cause cancer. I mean, what do we know about what EBV does to drive cancer in our bodies?
Well, the first thing to say, actually, is that these are biological accidents. This isn't, the viruses don't want to do this. It's just part of the virus life cycle that goes wrong. And what we've learned, in fact, is there are sort of, when you look at the seven or so viruses associated with human cancer, they fall into two categories. There's a group of viruses like Epstein-Barr virus and human papillomavirus that are directly causing cancer by actually expressing within your cells proteins and genes that help to drive the tumour, not all by themselves. Of course, there are other factors associated with that too. And then there are indirect effects of other types of virus. For instance, hepatitis C virus is associated with liver cancer, but that's about prolonged inflammation, setting up an environment in which cancer can develop. But we have learned an awful lot more generally, actually. So studying these viruses really elucidated a lot of the pathways that are common in all cancers, not just virus-associated cancers. And we estimate that probably around 15% of human cancer everywhere around the world is associated with virus infection.
Lawrence, as we heard earlier, EBV has also been linked to multiple sclerosis, an autoimmune disease that affects 1 in 500 people in the UK. Tell me about that. What's the current thinking on the link between EBV and MS?
Because of this close association of EBV with the body's immune system, it's very well controlled by the body's immune system. And the virus, once we're infected for life, and it lives in our B lymphocytes, in the cells of our bodies that produce antibodies. That's where the virus hides and persists. And what we've known for years is that many autoimmune diseases seem to have some association with EBV, but it really is many years of study, particularly a massive epidemiological study in the States, which showed that you can't get multiple sclerosis unless you are EBV positives, and also demonstrated and confirmed data from years ago that there's an increased risk of developing multiple sclerosis if you've previously had glandular fever. And then looking at this in more detail over the years, it's quite clear that EBV is a major driver to the development of multiple sclerosis. And what we don't know is whether the continued behavior or reactivation of EBV is contributing to the disease. And there are lots of studies looking at that now, but everybody is absolutely convinced now that Epstein-Barr virus is the major causative agent of multiple sclerosis.
Do you see a role then for an EBV vaccine in preventing MS or even treating it once it's already started to progress in patients?
Yeah, so I think for both, really. We know from lots of work now over the many, many years that one way of treating some of the EBV-associated B-cell tumours is to give people EBV-specific T-cells as a therapy. And it's the T-cells that are really important in recognising and destroying virus-infected cells. Some early studies using a similar approach in patients with MS demonstrated some efficacy of boosting the body's immune response by giving MS patients EBV-specific T-cells. And now there's lots of work going on with different vaccines. But there are two ideas here. One is to generate a therapeutic vaccine that can be used to treat MS, which we hope will also be used to treat certain cancers. But also, even if you can't completely prevent an individual from getting EBV in the first place, if you can dampen the initial effects of EBV infection so that individuals don't get glandular fever, you would then protect them from multiple sclerosis. And that's something that people are looking at the moment, particularly with the studies in the US with the Moderna vaccine.
So, Lawrence, if EBV is linked to so many illnesses, why aren't we just vaccinating everyone against it in the first place?
In Epstein-Barr virus, it's been looked at for many, many years. In fact, Tony Epstein himself who originally discovered the virus, worked for many years trying to develop a vaccine. But because this virus spreads so easily, it's so infectious at a young age, it's very hard to justify vaccinating the whole population. It's hard to do that, I think. But having said that, there are perhaps renewed interest. I think post-COVID, if we are indeed post-COVID, the whole area of mRNA vaccines has sort of injected the field with a new enthusiasm. There is a school of thought that says, actually, if we were to completely eliminate the virus, what would that do to our immune system? So there's an evolutionary aspect of this, which is perhaps the virus has helped the development of our immune system. There's also some evidence, particularly from animal models with other viruses similar to EBV in animals, that suggest that perhaps this is really important for helping us control infection with bacteria. And there's emerging evidence that as we get older, there is something about how EBV is important in helping to continue to support the development and the effectiveness of our immune system. So there is a worry that if we were to completely eliminate EBV from the human population, would that be a bad thing? Would it actually cause other untoward problems? Because why would a virus that's so dangerous, why would we keep it in our bodies? That there must be some evolutionary advantage to having EBV. And one idea is it helps our B cells to remain effective. So it's going to be interesting. But I think probably combinations of more effective vaccines and better drugs will help us control these diseases without necessarily completely eradicating the virus from our bodies.
So, Lawrence, 60 years on from this discovery, what do you think we still need to understand about EBV in particular?
Well, we've known for years that viruses are in some people lead to chronic long-term conditions. Chronic fatigue syndrome is an obvious one. And indeed, there's a wealth of literature suggesting that Epstein-Barr virus contributes to some cases of chronic fatigue syndrome as it does to long COVID. So I think this has sort of reignited interest in this whole idea that we've got to learn more about how the body responds to virus infections. It's been difficult to study this virus, actually, because it's so big. That's made it difficult to study in the test tube. It's difficult in the lab to manipulate this virus. We're just getting new technologies that can help us sort of manipulate that whole virus genome to study a little bit more about what it's doing and how it's working. And I think once we do that, we can understand more about the body's immune response to this virus and develop more targeted approaches, initially to treating cancer patients with EBV-associated tumours. We still live in a situation where, for instance, there's still young folk dying of Burkitt lymphoma in Africa. So developing better approaches, not only vaccines, but antiviral drugs. There hasn't been much of an effort to develop really effective antiviral drugs against Epstein-Barr virus. There are some that work that have been developed for other herpes viruses and happen to cross-react. But I think now there's a new impetus to starting to think about antiviral drugs alongside better vaccines.
Thanks again to Professor Lawrence Young. Before you go, I wanted to recommend an incredibly powerful episode of our sister podcast, Today in Focus. On Wednesday, Hannah Moore heard the story of Paola Mara, who ended her life last week in Switzerland after being told by doctors she couldn't be guaranteed a pain-free death from bowel cancer. My colleague Robert Booth met her and recorded her story. To find it, just search Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by Holly Fisher. It was sound designed by Tony Onochuku. And the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.